You're listening to The Guest List, a music industry podcast brought to you by Skiddle.
Hello everyone, and welcome again to The Guest List podcast brought to you by Skiddle and me, Angie Bandal. In the last episode, I called myself your favourite person you've never heard of, which I tried really hard not to say again today, because if that becomes the tagline of the show, that's really sad. I know this podcast is not going to skyrocket me into celebrity status, and this will never happen, but I'm just imagining people yelling that tagline to me on the street, so I really need something that sounds a lot cooler. If you have any ideas, feel free to send me any suggestions to at Skiddle UK on Instagram. I can't imagine you would, but the Instagram handle is there if you want it. Just grab onto it. Oh my God, I can't believe I just made that pun. Let's get onto this podcast before I embarrass myself any further. So, I'm a bit of a music tech geek. I love seeing where technology will go next, what's the next biggest thing, and you know, where is the relationship between music and tech going in the next couple of years. So, with that in mind, I spoke to three important people in the industry who you'll hear more about in just a second. And we chatted about live streams becoming a main part of the live music landscape post-COVID, how that could happen, and what's the, you know, the future of the relationship between music and gaming, and so much more. So I'm going to stop making bad puns about handles and let you crack on with the podcast. Enjoy. Hello and welcome to episode 7 of The Guest List podcast by Skiddle. This month we're chatting about all things music and tech, and I'm excited to announce our speakers today. With us we have Helen Sartori, director of The Rattle, which is a community space for musicians, producers, music professionals and startups. We also have Dr. Jonathan Lindley, a lecturer at the University of Huddersfield and manager of Sunbird Records in Darwen, Lancashire. And lastly, Helena Rice, an independent electronic artist currently making waves in the augmented reality space. So that was a very basic introduction, but I usually like to start this podcast by having our guests telling the listeners a little bit about who you are in your own words. In this case, it would be good to talk about what makes you passionate about music and its relationship with technology. So I'd like to kick things off by starting with Helen and just talking about your sort of relationship with music and tech and what you're all about, really.
Sure. I had a bit of a long and winding road with music. I started out as a classical musician. I was an incredibly nerdy classical music kid. Went to orchestra camp and piano camp and things like that. Ended up going to university to study music in a very old-fashioned syllabus. I went to Cambridge, which is very good for teaching you how to write fugues and string quartets, but not very good at teaching you how to be a modern composer. So I ended up swerving quite drastically and going into investment banking for 10 years for my sins, and ended up down the route of early stage tech and mergers and acquisitions. So when those two things came back together, I had a pretty unique viewpoint on how investment into music really differs from investment into early stage tech. That's kind of how I got involved with The Rattle, which is where I'm currently working, and how I also know Helena. So yeah, without going into too much detail, yes, that's my two strands of careers, what led me up to and where I am today, really.
That's great. Should we start with Helena?
Yeah, so I guess I sort of dabbled in music in various ways over the years, from kind of instruments at school through various bands. Probably about 8 years ago, I moved into electronic music. From there, as soon as I started performing in live sets, I was, you know, very much of the opinion that it had to be alongside visuals. So from those days, I was working with a VJ called VJ Mowgli and running sets in Ableton and Resolume, and then started experimenting with a little bit more of augmented reality over the last year. So working with a motion designer called Jan Patyrik and developing a kind of new live streaming or virtual streaming event, which involves kind of Kinect technology integrated into Unity 3D visuals. So I've been performing that probably for about 6-7 months now. And obviously that was kind of hastened on by the advent of COVID last year.
Cool. Jonathan?
Yeah, okay. So my dad actually started Sunbird Records as a platform for him and his friends. And at the time, I kind of had no interest in music, weirdly. I ended up getting into skateboarding, and through that sort of painting and graffiti and murals. So I ended up going to uni to do graphics, and then it was only further into it that I sort of really connected with animation. So I started making music videos for bands, and then, you know, it comes full circle, and I decided I'd had enough of making music videos for bands as sort of a freelance career, and decided I wanted to do it for my friends' bands. So then we kind of relaunched some of my records, 16 years on. And yeah, and then it just kind of grew from there. And then we opened the venue and the studio and did all that to support it. And I suppose that's how, I've, you know, I'm really invested in it now and kind of love doing that.
That's great. Thanks all for that. So you mentioned, Jonathan, that you opened sort of Sunbird as a venue quite recently. And I know that it's this sort of space of actually enjoying a gig and the kind of community feel is very much what Sunbird is all about. So how did you sort of initially find that shift when COVID hit?
Yeah, at first it was quite difficult. I think I was really interested because it was part of my university research. I was really interested in actually the social element of it. I was really interested in investigating what happened after subculture had died, so this sort of post-subcultural space. But actually now, this has kind of put it all on the... It's put the brakes on everything. But it's been really interesting because it's kind of, in a way, it's forced us to engage with more digital platforms and ways of supporting artists. So even though at the time, and even now, I'm still a little bit resistant, you know, no one likes change. But in a way, I think it's probably done a lot of good for us. We've been sort of forced to think more carefully about the way the label operated. So because it's a really tiny independent label, we've never had really more than 10 or 12 bands or artists. We never really invested that much in the things like a YouTube page. I know that sounds really daft. If anyone else is listening from a real label, you know, you're probably really connected with that. But what we used to do is we'd make music videos for our friends' bands, or, you know, we'd started tiptoeing into the live stream and stuff, but we did it to support them. We'd make them a video and we'd put it out on their YouTube page. And actually, I was quite keen on never having a YouTube page because I wanted to support these people, let them take the streams. And I suppose maybe it's forced us to mature a bit. So yeah, we've kind of invested a bit more in the infrastructure at the venue to allow us to do this sort of stuff. We were already sort of live streaming gigs, but quite sort of vaguely and not very well. You know, it was usually a GoPro in the corner of the room. It wasn't very well done. So now we've invested in some better equipment. Our sound tech, who has obviously been out of a job, he's got quite nifty now with a camera and a gimbal and things like that. And we've just actually managed to get hold of a generator. So he's going out into the woods and doing these sort of live streaming sessions when he can. Lockdown sort of has affected that at times, but we're still working our way around it. And it's been quite good fun, really. We've learned a lot. I think maybe a year ago he wasn't very good with a camera, and now he's very good. So it has had its sort of positive effects too.
And I know, Helena, you've been working a lot with live streams sort of during lockdown and experimenting with these really cool augmented reality live streams. How have you sort of found that, and what has the response been to that?
Yeah, I think it's been interesting because clearly, like, live streams isn't the same as a live event. And I think in one way, you know, we're talking about what's going to happen in the future, and people say, you know, can live streaming replace true live? And I think they're just really different from true live. And like one of the saddest things when you end your live stream, like normally you're going to have a drink with people that you've been performing to or with or whatever, and there's a kind of social element and all of that side, and that's lost it in live stream. However, I do think in some ways it's encouraged some of the sort of smaller networks that I belong to is actually make those stronger. So I was performing before, you know, maybe sort of kind of enthusiasts for underground electronic music. We'd be performing and meeting together in various kind of venues around London. And now, you know, in these circumstances, it's actually been, it's almost not just about the performance, but it's actually reaffirming for the network of people together that we're there and we're chatting to each other in forums for live stream. And I think in a way it's been good for me and the kind of project I'm doing, because we were already on this train to do something that was both audio and visual. We were already looking at sort of November 2019. And in a way, it's just accelerated forward the emphasis on the visual side of it. So when I'm performing live stream, the whole screen is pretty much blocked out by actually these Unity 3D graphics, in which my body is basically mapped through Kinect, so people can kind of just see me using the equipment. And it sort of minimizes the actual performance. In a way, it's actually suited the project that we were already kind of working on, and it kind of forced me to take a bit of a leap of faith mid last year to invest a bit more in the technology and find the right tech partners to kind of make that happen. So it's been interesting both for my own kind of single releases and to perform for the sort of networks of people I know. But also it's been getting involved with other networks, because obviously there's other events springing up that are trying to pull virtual performances together. So I think it's given me an opportunity to play events and to people that I would not really have accessed in the past. So for instance, a couple of weeks ago, I played for a platform called Gigmit, who are based in Berlin, who've got really hot on this. And we were on Twitch. And I think over the course of their performance, there was a number of artists, but we played to about 290,000 people. And, you know, my own performance probably did it to less than 2,000, but over the course of that time. But previously, you know, I was playing sort of smaller gigs and smaller venues. So it's kind of quite mind-bending what the opportunities can be. And I think particularly for the future, if you're complementing the live with live stream, it's like, how broadly can you go to new audiences? So I think it's kind of exciting, and there's opportunity, but I guess the sunrise, you know, it still doesn't replace live for me. And I'd like to bring that experience into a live environment as well in the future, all being well.
So I'm quite interested to, because a lot of the skeptics, I think, would think that live streaming is not sort of viable based on the sort of different technological challenges. So I'd be interested to hear, you know, what your experience has been. Have you, you know, had to learn quite a lot, or was it very easy to sort of integrate into sort of what you were doing already?
I've definitely had to learn a lot. And I also had to, it was good that you gave me a shove to invest in an upgraded graphics PC. So previously I would run graphics and audio off the same laptop, whereas now I've got a sort of double setup. I'm very lucky that my nephew actually is really good with this stuff. And funny enough, he used to work in a lot of gaming events as well. So he's been helping me out, making sure we've got the right webcam setup, etc. So the setup's become a little bit more complex than it was in the past. Things like learning about OBS and Restream and all the other technologies that make sure that I can also stream to multiple platforms at times. So at the moment, I would probably do YouTube, Facebook and Twitch simultaneously. We've tried doing Instagram. It's a slightly different format. You need to have a little bit of extra software to do that. So it's a bit more complex. So, I mean, yeah, I've had to learn a lot more about what works in each platform and how we reach out to it, when we do those events, how we pre-warn people about events, etc. So, and there's a big learning curve. Every time we do it, we add something else or we change something else. So we try and move it on. And I'm sure I'm in the same phase as many other artists who are equally kind of getting into these pieces of software as well.
Cool, thank you. Helen, I'd be quite interested to hear about your experiences with the Rattle in terms of live streams and any sort of roadblocks that you think that there are, or like it could be technological.
I think just like everybody else, I've been on a bit of a journey with live streaming since the beloved COVID came to visit us. We look after we have a community of about 150 in the Rattle, and probably 70% of those are active artists who are releasing, performing. A lot of them were already on tour or due to go out on tour when all this happened, and they had pretty mixed reaction when everything got shut down. A lot of them really, really launched themselves into live streaming. Helena's one of those and was really embracing new technology. Some of them said, look, I just don't think my music is the type of music that works on a screen. I think I need to have people in the room. I'm going to maybe spend this time just in the studio and making new stuff and preparing for when I can go out again. I don't think anybody expected us to be in this situation quite so long. So even those people are now coming around to the idea of maybe bringing in a hybrid element or some kind of small learning aspect to what they're doing. I think live streaming is really exciting in a lot of ways, especially if you've already got a strong fan base. It's a way to reach those people that you wouldn't necessarily be able to tour directly in their cities. It's a way to reach people that maybe don't feel comfortable going to a live venue or, you know, have access restrictions. But I'm still not convinced it's a great way to build a new fan base. There's a real problem still with discovery with live streaming. And, you know, live's always been a bit of an issue for that, but we used to have festivals and we used to have, you know, really big varied lineups and people who would curate live performance. And I'm still waiting to see who's going to step in on the live streaming front to be the curator of of good live performance, because we're still in that period where there's some people putting a lot of money and effort into really high quality performances, and some people who are still strumming on a guitar from their bedroom. And I'd actually be interested to hear Helena's thoughts on that, because you've been kind of on both sides. You've got an established fan base, but I know you're still in audience building mode. And have you found live stream to help that, or have you been concentrating different efforts into your fan building activities?
Well, I think in terms of fan building, actually, it has actually complemented. So the other side of what I do, as Helen probably knows, is some digital marketing, which is what I've done for other in other roles as well. Again, lockdown encouraged me to step up basically the online promotion. I do a lot of social media advertising, and interestingly, during that time, that sort of started to build a dialogue with fans, as introduced them to the brand. Fantastically, they are actually seeing the posts that are saying I'm going to live stream at this site, and they've communicated with me afterwards. Interestingly, one of them did say, fine seeing the visuals, but I prefer to have seen you performing live. So definitely we're missing maybe a little bit of that element. So I think it does work in one way, but I think it's one of those things where it's a new thing, and we can't force fit it into being another kind of live. It's going to be its own thing with its own kind of practices, I guess. A little bit of me is thinking, you know, how do we sort of brainstorm to make it to make live stream better, and maybe a bit more intimacy between the artists and between fans. You know, I think a lot of like the new events that try and replicate live, you can't replicate what's happening in a live environment. But you know, online has got so many amazing ways of connecting and reaching out. I wonder if we're going to see more and more integrations to kind of bring that intimacy, but it's going to be in a different way.
Yeah, I think that's going to be key. As once the platforms start to integrate people's back catalogue and upcoming live streams and hosting on platform and getting that crossover a little bit more smooth, I think things will be a lot easier. Right now, there's so many different pieces of software, so many different audience bases. It's, you know, your Instagram fan base might not necessarily be your Spotify follower base, and getting all those things to link up to get people to come and see something live online, I think is still a little bit tricky.
So, yeah, I agree. And probably one important thing for me to mention is that I haven't made paid ticketing work or donations work for me right now. And I know it seems to me that the bigger acts can do that because they've already got an established presence. And I don't know, I'm sure there are some small artists, independent artists who are making donations, et cetera, work for them. But I think like a lot of things online, even like streaming, for instance, it's easy for people to perceive that content as free if they don't have to take themselves to a place to see the artist. So I think that's another area that's going to be important to see live streaming work for more independent artists.
So Helen, you sort of mentioned your point was there's so many live streams out there. We need more of like a platform for curation. Is there anything that you've seen at the moment that is sort of going in that direction, or like the starts of something like that? Or is it still very much like a niche that could be tapped into?
Yeah, I think we're still in a stage where it's tricky to build a compelling online lineup because there's such a big chasm between the Madison Beer and the Dua Lipa and Billie Eilish, who are making hundreds of thousands of dollars off of a live stream, and everybody else who's struggling to get an audience, even though they're doing it for free. Yeah, there are lots of people who have started, you know, regular Twitch shows where they bring in different artists, you know, some of those kind of small curated lists. And you said you had some good experience with getting to a new audience using those, but it's not the same as, you know, National Theatre doing NT Live and putting promotional and marketing materials behind a specific show and kind of handling all of that side for an artist. It's still very much, we've got a slot for you, we'll help you with a little bit with the tech, but the rest is on you.
Something that I wanted to discuss is we've talked about some of the benefits of live streaming, how you can reach new people and new audiences that you wouldn't otherwise if it was a live performance, and you have a sort of wider sense of community. But is there a way that we can sort of see live streams being a part of the live music landscape once the physical aspect returns? Or do you think it's very much a sort of filler while we are waiting for life to return? Because I know, like you guys mentioned, with independent artists, it's a lot harder to make income out of that as opposed to the bigger artists.
I do think that, like Helena said, we're going to end up in a hybrid situation, hopefully, where there's a small live audience, depending on what our COVID restrictions are. As long as you have the right tech set up and you've learned to perform in a way that satisfies both audiences, you can also stream to a bigger digital audience and make it unique and fun for them. I don't think necessarily having to crack ticketed live stream is the barrier. I think there are a lot of ways to generate income digitally that aren't just off of ticket sales. We can talk at length about NFTs and, you know, digital scarcity and those kind of gaming economics that are coming in to digital entertainment, especially on the music side. But yeah, I think the first person to nail a truly great hybrid live and live stream event is going to knock out of the park. I really hope it's an indie.
Jonathan, do you have any thoughts on that?
The way I imagine this, when we go back post-COVID, the way I envision live streaming sort of functioning with our organisation is I'm kind of a bit worried about live streaming and the way it's going to affect the attendance of gigs. I always kind of, it's in the back of my mind all the time. But I think there's a couple of ways that we've kind of already envisioned it working, which would be things like, you know, it's quite obvious, but, you know, to interview the band just before the sound check and maybe to capture a little bit of the sound check in a live stream, just to give people that maybe have never heard of the band before for an idea of what might be on that night. I think the reason that we're thinking of doing this is Sunbury Records and its venue is quite a context-specific entity. So one of the issues we have is with it being such a small town, and something that's quite prevalent is that the people of Darwin aren't necessarily very well off. So they might only go out once a month. So it's hard enough getting them to come to the venue anyway. So the last thing I want is loads of people live streaming miles better events that you can watch from home. So I think the trick is we can maybe use that as sort of a marketing technique to convince people to actually come out the house and come and watch a band. You know, I think we can do that some way. But yeah, I am quite apprehensive about the entire happening. I think it's something that maybe doesn't or potentially might not support our organization as well as larger, more accomplished and prepared organizations. So it's a bit of an anxious time for us. But I think if we're clever, we'll be able to make it work with our work model.
Yeah, we haven't really talked about how this affects, like, compounds the problem for independent venues. I mean, I live in LA at the moment, and every week you see another venue either put up a GoFundMe or say they've had to close down or they can't pay their rent. And it's pretty heartbreaking. And although we've all been waiting for the kind of the green light to have live shows again, we do need to think about what consumer behaviour changes are going to, and what's going to be the lasting effect. And I do agree that, especially people moving out of major cities a little bit more, that the kind of let's go out and see a band thing might be a once a month thing, whereas it might previously been a once a week thing. So yeah, I do think it's going to be really tough. And even for those venues that want to embrace live streaming, it's pretty expensive tech outlay to really do it at high quality. Yeah, it remains to be seen really how the economics of that will play out and if there'll be somebody that comes in and essentially provides that for a fee to independent venues at large.
I've kind of just thought of this. I don't know if this... another sort of apprehension I have is that what live streaming does to music culture more broadly, and this has just come to me now, so bear with me, but I'm just thinking about what it does. So we're kind of streamlining and speeding up the process of culture disseminating from the artist to the consumer. So now you can almost, you pick up your guitar, you could improvise on the spot, live stream it, it goes straight into someone's ears. And actually there's a lot of steps that have been taken out of the process of, you know, the nostalgic process of producing music. So you used to actually write things down, write lyrics, you know, work with people, go to a studio, record it. And there's quite a lot of steps there that would be part of the process of refining music. I mean, and maybe, you know, I'm kind of talking very loosely now and very generally, but I wonder if more broadly the... taking out those steps, I wonder if potentially in the future it might just add to the noise. You know, so you've got tons of people constantly spitting out culture and that sort of process. I wonder if that might have a lasting sort of effect on music culture. I don't know. It's just sort of something I'm thinking about now.
Yeah, just taking that forward a bit. And again, Helena, I think you'd have a good response to this, but do you think it's going to change the way people make music? We already have kind of the Spotify effect, which is everybody gets to the hook in the first 8 seconds. There's no intro, chorus is within the first 30 seconds. It's great. It really has changed the way music's been written because people have access to the dirty little skip button. And the live streaming way is it's kind of comparable. People can kind of click off or move to a different channel or decide they want to go on YouTube instead, much easier than they can kind of leave a venue. I think that you have much less time to capture the imagination of your audience. And I wonder if that's going to make a difference in the way music is made.
It's interesting because I just think there's many different types of music and types of creatives as well. So I think, Jonathan, that's a really interesting point. I mean, your point could also be true of streaming and the fact that lots of independent bedroom producers can now freely distribute direct to Spotify, and that maybe increases the noise generally of music with kind of a proliferation of artists out there. But interesting, on the other sort of end of the spectrum, you've got like producers like Arca, if you're aware, where, you know, I've previously subscribed to her on Twitch, and she constantly does Instagram lives as well. And it's a weird thing. Sometimes she's just improvising a little bit and doing some stuff with music, and you're kind of part of her creative gang, if as it were, and you're experiencing her as an artist in a very different way. It's not that same kind of thing of it's a different end of the spectrum, the kind of lyric chordal working it out in a rehearsal studio and performing it, and they're both sort of valid, but it's almost like maybe, so what I'm saying is just it may not suit all types of music, but it may encourage some forms of creativity that we haven't seen before.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think, is it Arca that supported Bjork? I don't really know the music.
Yeah,
so my mum and dad told me about it, and it looked amazing. I think you're right. It really does facilitate new forms of maybe more mediatized culture, which not just, you know, the stuff I was describing a minute ago was very literal old school bands in a studio stuff. I think it really does open some doors, doesn't it? The sort of, particularly when you think about gaming and interactivity, and, you know, I imagine some of the stuff you were talking about, the sort of VR stuff, you know, as that becomes interactive and the possibilities are really sort of open. I wonder, I think my anxiety, like I said, I'm very resistant to change. I always have been. So the reason we opened the venue was actually in kind of a romantic sense. You know, venues are closing all over England, have been for the past 10 years. We did it specifically to try and support the emergence of a neo-tribal, was the way I described it, but a cultural scene that was almost not as interested as being connected to the World Wide Web and stuff. As it was more about fostering this music culture inside a building, you know, somewhere that we could see each other and dance to songs and drink beer and do all this stuff and just enjoy music. And I think this is really important for me because it's part of letting go of some of that. I think that you were right in saying that they can coexist. You know, the sort of classic way of producing music and the new sort of methods of production can, and if anything, they should empower each other. So I think if, you know, when I was saying before about live streaming speeding up the, you know, so you could improvise and go straight to someone else's bedroom, they can hear it. I think that's great. And I think actually that means that the people that do spend 2 years writing, a year recording, you know, doing it the old-fashioned way, I think that means that their production should show that the time's gone into it. But I think, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think it opens up a lot of doors.
And I'd probably say in the past, you know, people have always sort of shared in different ways. Like, you know, there's seeing the band and then there's owning it on vinyl, for instance, or CD or whatever other format. You experienced, you know, the recorded quite different from the live. And I think it's interesting to start seeing, I was just looking today at a virtual streaming concert, things for Laurie Anderson, actually, where suddenly there's like these layers of different bundles you can buy. So there's kind of, you can access the performance and you can get kind of a piece of merchandise, or you can have access to a kind of Q&A response as well. So it just sort of opens up another range of ways for people to interact with that artist. I think it sort of starts to blur the lines a little bit between experience and kind of recorded music, I suppose.
Yeah, I've seen really interesting models pop up. There's a startup that's purely focused on private, high value virtual gigs. So a group of 10 people will club together and buy an hour's set with their favorite artist, and it will be a live stream just for them, a little private party, and they'll get to talk to the artist. It's obviously targeted at like kind of the super, super fan level. But that's a thing that they would have never been able to do before, and has ended up supporting a lot of artists that were meant to be on tour through this time. Yeah, I think it's going to be very interesting. I feel like our general consensus is it's a really great thing for some artists and it's a really difficult thing for other artists. And whether or not we revert back to some kind of hybrid system or there really is a permanent change in the music industry is kind of remains to be seen.
I was just going to say, I just think that if a lot of people like myself, I don't think they'll need a lot of encouragement to really want to indulge in real life once the restrictions are lifted. I think a lot of people have suddenly realised what value there is on the fact that people are performing in venues near them. So I actually see there being a big boom to live and experiencing live performance once, you know, that's possible.
100%. I mean, the social aspect, I mean, I've never thought of myself as a super social butterfly person, but you really do start to miss it. I remember talking the other day to someone about trying to find music to stream with kind of the sounds of people and laid under it, like the sounds of a cafe or the sound of a busy bar, or just to kind of get that sense of being around humans again. And it's the social aspect is something that is extremely hard to crack on digital. You know, there's only so much you can do in the chat bar. And we're talking to startups about, you know, platforms where you can build your own avatar and send that avatar to a show and talk with people. But it's just, it's never going to recreate that feeling of being around hot, sweaty, you know, people spilling their beer on you. So I think it's great that we're going to have the choice that we could do either or. But a lot of that relies on indie venues being able to get through this period and not all be turned into flat. Sorry to make a pessimistic spin on you.
I'm thinking from my perspective as a consumer, because there are so many live streams out there, the ones in my eyes that are the most successful are like the ones you mentioned that have this unique angle, and it's all about unique experiences that you wouldn't necessarily maybe achieve in live. It is something separate to live, but also something beneficial. So for example, I'm a massive fan of the indie band Everything Everything, and for their fifth album release last year, they did a concert entirely in AR/VR. So you could buy a ticket and then attend their concert, and you'd have your own avatar, and you can even, for a small extra fee, have a little meet and greet with the band. So it had everyone's audio, and the band actually had their own sort of little avatars as well. It was like cartoon avatars, which was really cute. I found it a really like enjoyable experience because it's at that point, it was where everyone was kind of getting sick of people's live streams on Instagram. And it's that, it's something that's new and fresh, but obviously there's only so long that can go on. So I think based on sort of everyone's sort of discussions today, the sort of consensus seems to be it will sort of never replace live, because, you know, live, it has so many benefits, like, you know, being around a group of sweaty people, believe it or not, does wonders for your mental health and even physical health. So while it can't replace that aspect, it can add new experiences that you wouldn't necessarily have and can sort of supplement an artist's plan, you know, provided you have those resources like Helen mentioned. You know, obviously it's a little bit difficult with independent venues and artists, but you know, if you have that structure, then it could be something to be explored. I want to now talk a little bit more about the relationship between music and gaming, because I think, you know, we've seen records being broken with Travis Scott in Fortnite, for example, and I feel like COVID has really accelerated this relationship. Do you guys think we'll see more of that, and where do you think the sort of next innovation will be?
I feel like I bang on about music and gaming all day at the moment, because I do really think it is the model that will work to fix some of the economic problems that we have in the music industry. For whatever reason, we can go into Napster or whatever it is, we've managed to get to a point where we've trained people that music is free, and that's a really, really big problem. When you look at all the revenue generated by the entire music industry versus the box office and versus the gaming industry, you know, it's 10 times what the music industry is making at the moment. And that's because people have been trained that gaming content has value and they need to pay for it, and they don't mind doing that. I don't know if we're going to be able to reverse that completely in music, but, and Dana mentioned before, a lot of the inner economics of gaming, so creating digital products that have a scarcity value to them, creating vanity metrics or, you know, fan badges that your fans can earn, all of those things I think are going to come and be really important supplemental income streams for artists. But we all kind of have to go through a price setting exercise, which is really difficult. Like Jonathan was saying, there's so much noise out there and there's so many people willing to do it for free. So yeah, I guess I think about gaming and music a lot from the economic perspective because I'm a boring ex-investment banker. But Helena, I guess in the way that you interact with your fans, I feel like, do you feel like your fan base gets slants towards a gamer type, tech friendly profile, I guess.
I wouldn't necessarily say gamer, definitely tech friendly because it's kind of come out of electronic networks. So, and I would say that probably the way the music is, electronic music, definitely has a relationship over to the gaming audience. I do think that gaming might show the way for people back into music some way. So if you think about Twitch as a platform, obviously it's core gaming, but music is an integral part and it's becoming a sort of bigger part of some of the Twitch channels. There's some channels I've checked into where there are guys just producing at home and you can just check in and sort of see what they're doing. So I think, I mean, there's a strong relationship between the two fields. I think gaming also encourages the uplift of technology. So when people get VR headsets, et cetera, it's usually going to be because of gaming, and that music might take a benefit off that down the track. So in a way, I think music might get a hike off the back of gaming and the fact that people see themselves invested in gaming equipment and tech, you know.
I was just thinking about that that word innovation, and I think, again, I'm going to talk very loosely again, but I feel like one thing that we have seen in a lot of different fields is the shift from, and it starts with like the democratization of tools. There's a shift from consumer to producer. So if you think about things like Facebook and Twitter, you know, there must have been a time where people consumed news, and then all of a sudden everyone became a reporter and everyone was posting nonstop. And in a way, it kind of maybe eroded the sort of fabric of whatever that was. And, it, you know, now there's fake news everywhere and it's kind of, but I don't think that necessarily needs to be true of music. The one thing that I can see when I was thinking about the word innovation, though, is with particularly with gaming, you know, with things like Guitar Hero, you know, and there's tons of games like that. There's DJ Hero and stuff, wasn't there? You can totally imagine a world in the future where you'd meet up with your friends online, you'd play a gig and people come and watch the gig. And, you know, and that whole, you know, gaming could easily supersede whatever live music experience could be online if they can articulate it the right way. So I think there's a couple of things there that kind of maybe a little bit daunting, but it could also be really good fun. You know, I would totally sack off my studio and just play some advanced Guitar Hero to millions of people. It sounds great. But I suppose it's dependent on technology and how fast it, but that there's a lot of things that could happen there between music and gaming. I think it could be a really bright future, and the way that they could enmesh, because they've always been seen as separate things, or actually as like music supports gaming. You know, if you think about things like the old FIFA games where it had a soundtrack and it was game changing, you know, and everyone all of a sudden became a Block Party fan because it was on the FIFA soundtrack, you know, and it was for a lot of people, that was like an access route to indie music who maybe only listened to dance music or, you know, things like that. I think maybe the way that they converge could be a really, really interesting thing. I don't want to sound like a Luddite that doesn't believe in future technologies, but it does bring with, for me anyway, it does make me, I worry. And I think I worry because I love music so much. I worry that, like I said, with the news thing, it's a really naff example, I know, with Twitter and Facebook, but I do worry that it has the potential to undermine, you know, if everyone becomes a producer because they buy this guitar that they can play at home, I do worry that it undermines the tenure of, you know, previous works. So, you know, you can imagine a gig where everyone could take part at home. You know, does it undermine whatever the musician is? In fact, does the idea of a musician need undermining? You know, you've had this top-down system of incredibly wealthy musicians at the top sort of talking down to people. Maybe we should all be able to take part in it. You know, maybe that could be a really good thing. It's, I think, potentially the gaming and music convergence could totally change the dynamic and the discourse of music culture, and it might be a really good thing. Hopefully it is, but there's a lot of things it could do, I think.
Yeah, I had a long interview a couple of days ago about that exact issue, Jonathan, the tipping of the supply demand curve for the amount of people that are making music now and what that means for the professionalization of the career. And I'm on both sides of it. It's on the one side, I think it's great that everybody can make music, everybody has access to equipment, everybody can be creative. But on the other side, what it means is that these platforms that where the musicians used to be the supplier, the relationship's now shifted, the musicians are now the customers. The musicians have to pay to be on those platforms, pay to promote to be on the platforms, and because that's because of the oversupply. all comes down to this, people lowering the market value of what they're doing. But anyway, I was going to loop back around to the gaming conversation, because I think, like Helena said, the accessibility to technology is a huge game changer to let musicians come in and use this stuff more creatively and bring it into their practice. But I think what it's also doing is like you said, Jonathan, converging those two audiences that used to be very siloed, like a gamer audience and a music audience used to be like no crossover at all. And now we're seeing, I mean, we've just done a campaign with one of the artists in the Rattle, where instead of music videos, he built video games instead. And he had his music playing in the background, and it was a little platformer game, and the kind of the goals of the game fit with the themes of the EP. And it was kind of a really fun and low budget way, not only to make cool content, but also to reach an entirely new audience that were very warm and receptive to his type of music. On the other side, we're working with a startup called Paradiddle, which is creating essentially like a virtual reality Guitar Hero, but for drums. So we're putting all of the indie music into that platform. It has like, you know, a 40,000 user base that are all going to come in and see this new music and play along with it and interact with it in a way that they wouldn't be able to if they were streaming it on Spotify. So I think the technology part's really important, but being able to capture both sides of that audience, which used to be so separate, is a really, really big opportunity.
I'd probably just add that I totally sort of share Jonathan's concern in a way that there's an element with gaming, and also I think with Spotify, that music is something that you listen to while you're doing something else, as opposed to music having these iconic pieces that are moving and, you know, that are important in your life. I suppose I'd rather think two things. I think, again, there's like a spectrum of ways of being involved in music. So whether you're getting people involved in sort of a little bit like Rolly. So the company Rolly have created Rolly Blocks. They kind of make making music kind of easy and almost like a game, which is just keeping people engaged in music. So it's a way of engaging a wide audience. That's not necessarily the same as certain artists developing into these kind of new iconic artists. I suppose just generally fairly optimistically, I feel like, you know, there's been waves of technology that have affected music, you know, so deeply since the beginning of recorded music. You know, at first it sort of feels uncertain, but eventually things find their place, because people will always love music and they want to love these, you know, fantastic artists, and those artists will always kind of float to the top. So that may be a fairly optimistic view, but I think that it will find its place with the technology, and that again there will be able to be this sort of coexist of great artists and technology. I hope so anyway.
That's great. Thanks, Helena. It sounds like we're in a really sort of exciting time at the moment for both gaming and live streaming, where we're very much in the refinement stages. Like, a lot's been done, and we're still sort of working on it. And I feel like the sort of general consensus also for myself is that it has the possibility to coexist with the physical live. It's just really about, you know, like I mentioned, refining that and sort of tapping into a niche that hasn't been provided before. So I'm afraid I'm going to have to sound like a party pooper now, but we've run out of time, and I think it's a good place to wrap up the conversation there. Although I think we could be talking about this for hours on end. So thank you so much to our speakers who took part. And if you're listening, make sure you check out these amazing people and all the great work they're doing in the industry. So bye, guys, and thanks again for a great discussion.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
Thank you. See you later.
You're listening to The Guest List, a music industry podcast brought to you by Skiddle.